This is the Walking Home from the ICU podcast. I'm Kaylee Dayton, a nurse practitioner and ICU consultant. I help teams create awake and walking ICUs through evidence-based sedation and mobility practices. By hearing from survivors, clinicians, and researchers, we'll explore how to give ICU patients the best chance to walk out of the ICU and go home to survive and thrive. Welcome to the ICU Revolution. Creators of the ABCDF bundle. The bundle's mission is to produce patients who are more awake, cognitively engaged, and physically active, to facilitate patient autonomy and the ability to express unmet physical, emotional, and spiritual needs. If we zoom out more, the main objective of this approach is to prevent and treat delirium and ICU-acquired weakness. What I am seeing in teams that I'm working with is that they may have some understanding of delirium, but many do not know how to properly perform a CAM test. Nurses have told me, quote, despite working here for 18 plus months, this is the first time I've really been taught how to do this test, let alone why. There is a lot of documentation of unable to assess for the CAM charting for intubated patients. Some seasoned nurses have told me that they thought CAM was not appropriate for intubated patients, and that's why they chart unable to assess. Oftentimes, this unable to assess is charted alongside a RAS of negative one or negative two, but the reality is the RAS is much deeper, and that is why they cannot perform a CAM test. Their patients are rendered unable to engage and show their true brain function. This means that many to most of their patients can be suffering from acute brain failure without any detection, diagnosis, let alone treatment. As John Devlin said last episode, a patient being deeply sedated without an indication should be considered a never event, as it's even more dangerous than line and device removals. Our teams can be working so hard to treat all sorts of other organ dysfunction, but simultaneously and inadvertently causing, exacerbating, and or prolonging acute brain dysfunction. Ultimately, the CAM screening tool should be considered as important as a troponin level or creatinine. It is one of only two validated tests that can detect delirium with accuracy. Considering that delirium doubles the risk of dying in the hospital, it is alarming to find some ICU teams still have not implemented the CAM tool, and others are not frequently using it, and especially not discussing it in rounds. I've been in contact with a physical therapist that left an awake and walking CVICU and moved to a different part of the country. She has been dumbfounded to find how behind her new hospital is in modern sedation and mobility practices. She has been told, quote, oh, we practiced the ABCDF bundle. We rolled it out a year ago. And yet, almost everyone is deeply sedated, and they have not implemented standardized CAM screening in their ICUs. The D of the ABCDF bundle is for delirium. Assess, prevent, and treat delirium. I will forever repeat, the ABCDF bundle is not just SAT and SBT documentation. It is not an on and off switch for sedation. If our teams do not fear delirium more than unplanned extubations and treat CAM scores like a daily creatinine, then we have not yet achieved an ABCDF bundle culture and mastery. This episode, Dr. Austin joins us to dive deeper into the D and guide us to evaluate whether or not our teams are truly practicing the D of the ABCDEF bundle. Dr. Austin, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Can you introduce yourself to our audience?
Hey, I'm Adrian Austin. I'm a geriatrician, pulmonologist, and intensivist. I work at UNC at Chapel Hill in North Carolina, and I'm a delirium researcher.
I'm so excited to have you on. We're doing each episode for the next 2 months is dedicated to each element of the ABCDF bundle. So today we're going to be really diving into delirium, but I wanted to start from the very beginning. I know a lot of my listeners obviously know what delirium is. We hear the word all the time in the ICU, but I think it's helpful to, before we get into the details of it, to zoom out again and talk about what is delirium.
Delirium is a term with a thousand names. The older term was acute brain failure, which was very dramatic. There's a term that's thrown around by CMS that's encephalopathy or toxic metabolic encephalopathy. We, as geriatricians and as, you know, delirium researchers like delirium, it's an acute change in mentation, an acute state of confusion that's defined by inattention. So something happens to a person and then they have a change in their mental state, which is defined by inattention. And it can wax and wane or fluctuate, however you want to say it. But that inattention piece is key. So one of the key things is it's not disorientation. I know we are trained as physicians, nurses, therapists to assess for orientation, which doesn't tell you a whole lot about whether somebody is delirious or not. That's an independent association in assessment. So yeah, that's what delirium is. It's incredibly prevalent.
That's interesting because I am seeing that sometimes because we use it so often, we see it so often, we assume that we know how to screen for it. And I think sometimes we're not doing the full CAM assessment. We're not doing the save a heart. We're just saying, okay, well, they follow command, so they must not be delirious. When, and I've seen myself, patients can be following commands. They can tell you where they're at, but you go to do save a heart and they're all over the place. They just lose attention. So it's one of the key features, and that's why we have these validated screening tools like the CAM ICU, so that we can really catch those nuanced features of delirium. Because I've had patients say, you know, when I ask them, can rocks float on water? And they'll say, depends on how solidic the water is.
Right.
But they go to save a heart, and by the end, they're off in another world. They're not really squeezing your hand appropriately.
And I think that speaks to the fluctuating nature of delirium. Another way I describe it is it's really easy to disorient a person and then reorient them. In our hospital, like many large academic hospitals, there's multiple different buildings. And if you come in the middle of the night in the emergency department and then, let's say, go to one of our wards and then have a decompensation and get shipped up to our ICU, there's a very real chance you would have been in three different buildings throughout the hospital within a short amount of time, probably changed the day because you rolled over at midnight. So you could already not know exactly where you are or what the day specifically is. And so be quote unquote disoriented. But it can be easy if somebody is not delirious to reorient them. You know, you say, well, you're in X building and today's actually Tuesday, the 25th, or today's actually Monday, the 25th. It's an aside. So you try that with a person who's inattentive and you can correct them, you know, ask them to do a save a heart or days the week backwards. You could say, well, no, this is how you would do that test. They're not going to retain that. Delirium will preclude them from being able to retain that. It's just very different parts of the brain that are affected and not functioning depending on whether it's delirium versus some other int.
And since we're talking about the ABCDF bundle, D is for assess, prevent, and treat. And I think we all assume that that's what we're doing, but I think we need to understand what that really means. What are the tools to prevent and treat delirium?
That's a $6 million question. Preventing delirium, we have firmer data for ways to prevent delirium, and it's good humanistic care is the core principles. And what I would say is good geriatric care, minimizing offending medications, you know, avoiding benzodiazepines or medications that are strongly anticholinergic, like diphenhydramine, Benadryl being the big offender. Getting people up out of bed, putting their feet on the floor, getting them moving, removing devices that are unnecessary, bladder catheters, central lines, arterial lines, these things that we commonly use in the ICU to stabilize people acutely and to monitor them and assist in their care. As soon as we can get them out, not only does it reduce the risk of potential infection for indwelling devices, but it makes mobilization easier and also independently helps reduce the risk of delirium. Trying to maintain a good sleep-wake cycle, having the family around, engaging people during the day, allowing them to rest at night. Yeah, just creating a more home-like environment. instead of the sterile ICU environment, or the ways to prevent delirium. When it comes to treatment, there is no good proven medical treatment, no pharmacologic treatment for delirium. There have been many large trials studying various medications for delirium. They've all been negative. The largest one would be the, or the largest one until recently was the MIND-USA study, which combined or compared a typical antipsychotic, haloperidol, versus an atypical antipsychotic, which is aprazidone, versus placebo, as an intervention for delirium, and that was a completely negative trial. So we don't have a proven single agent for the treatment of delirium. So prevention is key, and it comes down to less medications, if anything.
And I think there's some studies that show benefits to the same methods for prevention as that can be used for treatment.
That's correct. The non-pharmacologic treatments can be used for treatment as well. The data isn't as strong for treatment as it is for prevention. But the great thing about the sort of what I call humanistic bundle is it's not harmful. So at the very least, you're not making people worse. And it, if it gives you benefit, even that if that benefit is small, it's better than what we standardly do, I would argue.
Yeah, I appreciate a lot of these trials. We are looking at the rate of delirium, like how often it occurs. But included in a lot of our trials as well is the duration. So within some of these trials, looking at mobility and the impact and just the ADF bundle in general, we see that not only was the rate lower, but oftentimes the duration was lower which you know, implies that we were able to treat delirium with these approaches as well, because we're always going to have delirium. It's always going to be something that patients show up with on admission. There are so many risk factors that within the ICU, no matter how well you humanize the ICU, yet we absolutely have certain elements ingrained into our culture, into our practices, into our routine that cause delirium. So when I hear teams say, oh yeah, we practice the A to F bundle, but they automatically start sedation on everyone that's intubated. They're maybe giving some benzodiazepine pushes. In my mind, when you give sedation, you're taking away a lot of those tools to prevent delirium. They cannot get real sleep. They're not able to mobilize. They're not able to connect with their families. They're not getting agents that cause delirium. So what are your thoughts about how we should approach management of sedation when we really are trying to practice the D, which is to assess, prevent, and treat delirium?
I think a less is more approach is warranted. I've been thinking about this a lot lately too, because we have a lot of experience with sedation and delirium during COVID, which has, I think, brought this issue back to the forefront. When it comes to sedation, light sedation or minimal sedation is superior to deep sedation for our patients. That's, I think, well supported with the evidence, because it facilitates engagement with reality, it reduces PTSD, and it allows people to get up and move, which the more you move, the easier it is to get people off the ventilator and ultimately out of the hospital. A no sedation or incredibly light sedation after induction for mechanical ventilation, after you intubate somebody and place them on a ventilator, a minimalistic approach to sedation, I think, should be the paradigm we're following. Unfortunately, it is not. Now, with COVID, we really saw some deep sedation practices because we were trying to maintain a mechanical ventilation principle that is well evidenced, supported by strong evidence, and that's low tidal volume mechanical ventilation for ARDS. The problem is it's not a very comfortable mode of ventilation, so it can require a lot of sedation for patients to tolerate that, particularly if they're young and they have a strong drive to breathe in excess of what the ventilator is providing. That was our experience time and time again during COVID. So I've been thinking recently that there's likely some point of diminishing returns where the effects of sedation will outweigh the positive benefits of low tidal volume ventilation in certain patients. This is, I realize, heretical to pulmonologists, myself being a pulmonologist, but I don't think I'm the only one who's been talking about this. I heard Margaret Herridge bring this up at a conference a few months ago. I don't know. It's an interesting thought. There's no good guide point for that right now. But in general, my practice has been to allow people to wake up after intubation. And if they are, you know, agitated, which I don't really like that term, it's not descriptive. If they're having a behavior that is harmful to themselves or to others, usually to themselves, which they're trying to self-extubate would be the behavior, then you can give some sedation. Because, and I prefer low dose sort of intermittent opiates for that. I would imagine, I don't have the conscious experience of being on a ventilator myself. I can imagine that is a noxious stimuli and some occasional opiates can reduce that. It can be helpful for patients. Like so many things in medicine, I think there's a U-shaped curve where too little will lead to agitation because people are in distress, and too much, they over-sedate. And you got to find a sweet spot. And that's sort of what my research is focusing on, is finding the sweet spot for opiates to keep people comfortable and involved and minimally delirious. Currently, I think it is fair to say we greatly err on the side of too much.
And I love the way you're bringing the focus to sedation use as the parameter needs to be that can they still engage with their environment, mobilize, communicate, be autonomous. You know, I talk about an awake and walking ICU, and I think sometimes it's perceived as a no sedation unit. It's not, we use sedation when there is an indication for sedation. Sometimes an indication for sedation is a RASS of 3 or 4. I mean, I'm hearing the word agitation be used very arbitrarily. And sometimes they're using it. I mean, I've been on units where I'm hearing that word be used and I'm seeing the patient simultaneously, and the patient looks like a RASS of 1, maybe 2 occasionally, right? They're restless. They look uncomfortable. We can treat those things. We need to figure out what's causing it. We can treat that, but we're using agitation to describe restlessness and discomfort. When agitation is in the literature defined by a RASS of 3 or 4, those are dangerous behaviors. That's when you really have actual risks and you might need some sedation. But when you use that, does that warrant a RASS of -2, -3? Or can we use sedation to achieve what you're describing? Being awake, calm, communicative, autonomous, mobile. That really should be, for most patients, the sedation level that we're looking for. And all of that so that we can actually use the tools to prevent and treat delirium. Otherwise, we're giving delirium and then we're masking it with sedation and we're making it impossible to prevent or treat it. But I think sometimes from a nursing side, I personally did not appreciate the risks associated with delirium. I knew what it was. I could diagnose it. I could use a CAM really effectively. I hated it because it made my job so much harder, but I wasn't really panicked about it. And I think the lack of panic about delirium influences our sedation practices. So why should we be really concerned about delirium on top of all the other things that are happening in the ICU?
Sure. It's funny, just as an aside, what you brought up, that my 15-second overview of delirium, the history of delirium research, is we defined what it is and its prevalence. And then we said, oh, we knew it was prevalent. Should we care? It's bad. And now we're at the what do we do about it phase. And so talking about why is it bad? So delirium, yes, no, and duration of delirium are two different exposures, two different ways to think about delirium. So if you have any delirium versus no delirium, and the more delirium you have.
If you've been listening to this podcast, you're likely convinced that sedation and mobility practices in the ICU need to change. The ICU community is facing incredible difficulty with the trauma from the pandemic, staffing crisis, and burnout. We cannot afford to continue practices that result in poor patient outcomes, more time in the ICU, higher healthcare costs, and greater workload for the ICU team. Yet the prospect of changing decades of beliefs, practices, and culture across all disciplines of the ICU is a daunting task. How does this transformation start? It can begin with a consultation with me to discuss your team's current practices barriers and to formulate a plan to help your ICU become an awake and walking ICU. I help teams master the ABCDEF bundle through education, consulting, simulation training, and bedside support. Let's work together to move your team into the future of evidence-based ICU care. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to find out more.
Every day of delirium confers an additional risk of pretty much any outcome that we've measured being worse. And so you can measure concrete outcomes at different time periods, like mortality, ICU mortality, hospital mortality, 6 month, a year mortality, 2 years. Things that ICU physicians, we are interested in duration of mechanical ventilation. And then downstream from that, it leads to, you know, longer on the vent, long in the ICU longer, duration of hospitalization. All these things are worse if you're delirious. Then things that are a little bit harder to track, but are I would say, incredibly important for our patients and their families are ability to go home versus to a skilled nursing facility or inpatient rehab facility or a LTAC. Ability to return to prior functional status, to participate with PT. It's really difficult to participate with PT in the inpatient and certainly the outpatient setting if you're delirious. It's hard to engage a delirious patient. It's harder, I should say. And then one of the things that got me interested in this field is the ability to return to your prior cognitive function. Go back to work, to resume the things that bring our patients joy and value in their lives are all affected if you are delirious. It is, one of my mentors has taught me, and she's got a great slide going through the comparative literature. It's the equivalent of having an acute MI of the brain. If we look at outcomes, it carries the equally poor outcomes compared to having an acute MI. It's just a catastrophic injury to the body. And that's independent of just severity of illness. It is an additional risk factor and insult to the body.
And you mentioned, you know, the terminology acute brain failure as being extreme, which I totally understand that perspective. I also appreciate that terminology because it helps us, at least from a nursing side, it helps us understand the urgency of what's going on. Because in the ICU, we're hyper-focused on kidneys, liver, lungs, you know, these single organ systems. And if we have an elevated troponin, boom, we're on it. If we have an elevated BUN or creatinine, we're on it, right? But when we have a positive CAMP score, we're like, well, yeah, they're in the ICU. So, you know, and we can't deal with their agitation. So we have to sedate them more because they have delirium. It's sometimes more the perspective because we don't appreciate it as the MI of the brain. We don't appreciate it as this is an organ dysfunction/failure. I mean, we are having brain damage actively occurring. And I think that's one of the barriers to really mastering the D is that we don't appreciate the urgency of it. I appreciated Dr. Ely's study from 2004 showing for every 1 day of delirium, there's a 10% increased risk of death. I mean, if we really talked about it at the bedside, I perceive that it would shift our decision-making, that we would be much more urgent about treating this, quote, acute brain failure. I know we probably never standardize that terminology. You know, I think we're probably moving more towards encephalopathy per CMS documentation and reimbursement and things like that. But if we could even just culturally understand that this is a medical emergency, not just an annoying thing that just happens to almost everybody and we can't do much about it, I think it would change how we reacted to it and how we started off a patient's course in the ICU.
I completely agree. I see it as an emergency. I think delirium has an advertising problem.
Yes.
And the American Delirium Society, which I'm a member, does a good job in helping with that and helping have a sort of a central warehouse for people with an interest in delirium to function. But yeah, it doesn't carry the same dread within clinicians as an acute MI or acute renal failure, where I would say it's equally as deleterious. It's another organ system that has failed.
Someone mentioned at ADS that delirium is associated with worse outcomes than any other organ failure. Now, I didn't see a study to support that, but that was just what was mentioned. I thought that was at least a very interesting thought.
I'm not sure about that. I don't know the evidence behind that statement. It's as bad, I would say, as our, the other organ failures we encounter in the ICU for our long-term outcomes. If your brain doesn't function when you leave the ICU, the rest of the body's not going to function well. You have to have your brain to engage in life.
And delirium increases the risk of long-term cognitive impairments by 120 times. And yet we're arbitrarily giving neurotoxic medications, essentially, or deliriogenic medications without really questioning whether or not they're necessary. We're not oftentimes really trying to minimize it. And I don't think it's a common perspective to really be sedating with a goal of having patients be more of a RASS of zero so that they can mobilize.
Right.
And if we're not doing that, are we really practicing the ABCDF bundle?
I would say we're not. And I would say that prior to sort of 2018, 2019, at least my experience where I work and also from talking to colleagues at other institutions, is that we culturally were doing a better job of practicing lighter sedation and achieving that RASS of hopefully zero, realistically, usually negative one, maybe negative two. And that's okay. You can engage people that are lightly sedated.
It's harder.
I would prefer them to not be sedated at all, but you know, it's incremental steps in many ways. But we took a big step back during COVID because of the deep sedation practices initially, because we were trying to avoid as clinicians going into the hot zone pre-vaccine. And you know, when we were in PPE critical shortages, I mean, there were other competing things that sort of forced our hand on that, realizing that we were balancing risk and benefits. And then as can happen within medicine, things became culturally ingrained and they just have carried over. And now we're back to where we were, I think, a decade ago with a lot of our sedation practices.
I think that's an accurate assessment. That's what I'm seeing throughout the country. And the AF bundle has culturally morphed into this mandated charting for SAT, SBT, CAM, RAS. And it's more of a mandatory on-off switch for the sedation. So when they say, we practice the bundle, we've got it covered, meaning that it's in their charting system. And yes, they maybe do an SAT every day, but those SATs are done with turn the sedation off, unmask the delirium, turn sedation back on. So if we're automatically starting sedation on everyone without asking, we're not necessarily really practicing the bundle. If we're sedating them to the point that they can't really achieve the goal of the bundle, which is, I mean, Dr. Brenda Penn said in her article, it's to have patients that are awake, cognitively engaged, physically active and communicative and autonomous to express their needs. So if we're sedating to have patients unable to do that, we're not practicing the bundle. But what about mobility? If we're not mobilizing patients when they really should be mobilized, there are patients that obviously cannot mobilize. But if we're not practicing early mobility, are we really mastering the D of the bundle?
I would say no, we're not. One of the mind-blowing things I observed time and time again during doing inpatient geriatric wards. So this is the non-ICU wards, but it's the geriatric medical approach that I received during my geriatric training, was the change in people's psyche and mentation that putting their feet on the ground or standing them up can have. You take patients who are delirious or agitated. I'm thinking of the patient with baseline dementia who's having some psychoses, getting them up, opening the blinds, and just having them stand with assistance is a game changer. I mean, it can really shift people's perspectives and bring them back to reality. It's just that simple act of of putting someone's feet on the floor and getting them out of bed. It's still, when I observe it, still in older adults in the non-ICU setting, it's so stark where it can be that it sort of blows one's mind.
I don't know how to make that louder for the people in the back. You know, it's one of those things that it doesn't make sense to most people that have practiced for a long time in a certain way. If you're just used to automatically sedating in response to signs of discomfort and even agitation, it's hard for them to believe that patients can and should be mobilized when they're having these episodes. And I'm not talking about getting people out of bed when they're rest of 3 or 4. In those cases, I think it's perfectly appropriate to give them some Precedex to get them to a more appropriate RAS of 0, maybe +1, maybe -1, then to mobilize them so we can really treat the delirium. So where you're using things like Precedex, I think sometimes suboptimally, because we're not then actually treating the delirium. We're still using it to mask it. But I see it as an opportunity to then mobilize them, actually communicate, engage with their family, actually treat the delirium and get them out of it. Otherwise, Precedex becomes a long-term plan and they still are having prolonged episodes of delirium. But you have to see it for yourself. You have to see the patient that thinks they're in Mars suddenly start to make eye contact, follow commands, even write on a clipboard. So you can see it profoundly, even in psych wards, on the acute care floors, and especially in the ICU. It can be extremely dramatic. And that's what I'm hearing from listeners, from teams that I'm working with. They're astounded by the difference and the impact it makes and how much easier it makes the rest of their shift and the rest of the hospitalization by making that decision in that moment to treat the delirium, to actually get them up, deal with the agitation through mobility. I worry about teams. Obviously, the bundle is a lot to implement all at once. I appreciate that. I also see difficulty in only addressing sedation. So if they say, well, we're just going to avoid sedation or we're just going to lighten sedation and then we'll get to the mobility stuff later. Because in my mind, as a nurse practitioner, that's going to be really difficult for my job, because delirium is going to happen, you know, unavoidably for many of our patients. But if we don't have mobility available, how do we then react? How do we respond? How do we keep patients safe during delirium if we can't wear them out, if we can't get them lessen the severity at least with mobility? Then we really get stuck with, okay, now we've got a patient that is getting agitated. Now we are stuck sedating them. And then once that sedation starts, it's easy to sneak into deeper and deeper sedation, especially when we don't have the goal of mobilizing them. So if we're not mobilizing our patients, are we practicing the bundle? Are we even?
I would say no. I mean, it's all works together.
And then the F is another element, right? We know that family is so powerful. So what are your thoughts about family visitation, the family role in the ICU, especially when it comes to the D part of the bundle?
The evidence for family isn't as strong as some of the other elements. There is a recent meta-analysis examining this that shows that families' involvement is beneficial for reduction of delirium. It's not going to harm the patient. And I would argue, I think it's a very easy argument to make, that it is part of good humanistic care and of caring for the patient and their family, because the family is equally as important. Patients who have families that are involved will do better after they leave the hot ICU environment, because they're going to be the caregivers, usually. Usually they are. And if a patient has a family member that wants to be involved, they are certainly, in my mind, much more fortunate than some of our patients who don't, which is something we observe as well. Speaking from my own experience, so our unit here is an open unit, meaning that families can come by. We ask them to sort of limit it during our shift change times, you know, for a couple of hours during our 2 shift changes, but certainly make exceptions. But otherwise, family can come as go as they please. My grandfather, who was very near and dear to me, passed away in an ICU in a rural part of the country. And I went in knowing that he was going to pass away imminently, expecting that open ICU and being told that I was going to have to wait till visitation time to see him, you know, and I'd flown across the country and driven multiple hours. And I'm just like, wait, what? And it was a really sterile, cold environment. And we pretty immediately moved him to an inpatient hospice facility, primarily so we could be close to him and vice versa. And that was just, it just reinforced, I think, the way we can provide empathy for patients and their families who are dealing with complex life-altering situations by preserving those relationships that are important for our patients and for all of us as humans.
Absolutely. I had similar experiences with two of my grandmas during COVID, and it felt really inhumane. And they both suffered delirium during their stays. No one is familiar to them. There was no grounding presence, voice for them. And it was absolutely horrific, and it felt inhumane. I do think some of those studies, when they're conflicting, I think sedation should be part of the consideration in those family studies. If patients are deeply sedated, how impactful can family be? What are your thoughts?
I don't think they're going to be the family involvement would be harmful. I think that's unless the family member is actively in there trying to harm someone, which
we've all seen, but
it's tongue in cheek. But barring that, having a loved one around is not going to harm someone, and would probably allow for less sedation. I mean, if you wake up in an environment you're unfamiliar with, you're probably going to be distressed, and a familiar face can be very calming. A familiar voice can be incredibly calming, and bring people back to reality.
I think there was a fairly recent study showing that family visitation decreased sedation use in the ICU. And if I find it, I will put it in the links of this into the transcription of this episode, because that's, I think, one of the findings in a fairly recent study that I found. And it makes sense. And I think we've all seen it. And we also saw the opposite during COVID. The less family that was there, the more we ended up sedating patients, partially because of necessity. When you have low staffing ratios, you have all these crises, right? The family can be kind of sitters in some cases, right? They help keep patients engaged, interactive. They can be key in communicating with their patients, all these things that ultimately prevent and treat delirium. I love that your unit is open visitation. That's the same with the unit that I come from. I think teams that fully practice the ADF bundle, when they're really proactive about delirium, they don't kick families out after 7. They understand that this is part of humanistic care that overall improves outcomes and is part of being humane caregivers. Anything else you would share with the ICU community?
We have to sedate our patients less. And to quote Dale Needham, the brain bone's connected to the body bone. The more that we can do to minimize delirium, the more we can do to help our patients return to their lives and hopefully thrive after their ICU experience.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dr. Austin. I appreciate all you're doing for the community, all your research, and everything you're doing, boots on the ground with your patients there. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks.
Schedule a consultation for your ICU, as well as find supportive resources such as the free ebook, case studies, episode citations, and transcripts, please check out the website www.daytonicuconsulting.com.